From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 21st installment in our ongoing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the USSR from the revolution in 1917 until its dissolution in 1991. Luciana, welcome.
Thank you, Don. How are you?
Very well. I'd like to start with a paraphrase of a quote talking about Trotsky, which we're going to try to work our way into as we now focus on what happened in Russia specifically, where E.H. Carr, the British historian, journalist, etc., said essentially Trotsky was a hero during the heroic times of the revolution and no longer needed once the heroic period had ended, something to that effect.
That's why he was for a heroic permanent revolution.
That's right. I bet that's it. And he poses against that that Stalin was better suited to what was actually done, which was let's now construct, you know, do the mundane work of constructing an economy and a body politic, and that's what happened. And so we can talk about this period now. Let's from the revolution going forward.
Yeah. Sure. We left Trotsky in Spain in the last conversation.
Without cab fare, by the way.
Sorry, what?
Without cab fare, by the way. We left him in Spain with no cab fare. Go ahead, I'm sorry. I had to be snarky.
So he wasn't... He wasn't even in Spain, but anyway, we were discussing the influence of. We were talking about Trotsky,
right?
Yeah,
his influence.
This Spanish Civil War,
right? Exactly.
And we noticed the chaos in the economy, the factionalism, the splitting, the 3 days in Barcelona, the fight against the United Front or the resistance to the United Front and all kinds of mishmash and confusion and chaos caused by the influences of Trotsky, though I am just simplifying. But anyway, there he was. We were in Spain in between 1936 and 1939, pointing out the faults, the failures in the theory. And so now we have to ask, so who is this Trotsky? And this will take us back to the early 1900s.
Right.
In order to find out who is Trotsky, we're going to have to talk about Lenin. So his followers, that is, Trotsky's followers, say that he was the true heir of Lenin and Lenin's political position, and that Stalin betrayed the revolution, that Stalin's theoretical and political views differed from those of Lenin, and so did his practices. This is Trotskyism. Essentially, why we need to talk about Trotskyism is because this is in being in this attitude that Trotsky was the true heir of Lenin and that Stalin betrayed the revolution really induces people who are inclined to be Marxist to dismiss the experiment in the Soviet Union, which was a workers' and peasant state working toward communism through paths of socialism. In other words, if we want to reconstruct a left, a revolutionary left in future, we have to understand what the Soviet Union was and not fall into the cliches and tricks of dismissing it as a distorted, deformed worker state and just toss it out of history. We can't do that. We have to understand what it was and why it fell and what forces helped him to fall and how to avoid being those forces or contributing to those forces. So, yeah,
and just let me to interrupt for a second. So, I mean, at the beginning of this, we're talking about the Second Congress of what was called the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. And the split happens. The split happens between two sides, one advocating that the party should be people who are, you know, immersed in revolution, not just, you know, the masses with revolutionary leadership, but revolutionaries themselves. And the other side is like, well, look, we'll be the revolutionaries and we'll go get the masses. And that is where the party split. And Lenin was on one side and Trotsky on the other.
Yeah, but I think the path to that point is also important to trace.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to jump the gun. I just wanted to.
No. That's exactly. It's the split is over the composition of the party,
right.
And well, it's over the statute, the constitution of the party. Number one item is that the Central Committee, the party, the leadership would be professional revolutionaries. So let's go there, okay?
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, Trotsky was the true heir of Stalin. Trotsky was the true heir of Lenin. And Stalin betrayed the revolution, yada, yada. So we have to look at these claims. They have to be tested. So we must go back to the beginning. When two key factions formed in 1903-1904 within the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, or Workers' Party, really. The Russian Social Democratic Labor Party was formed in 1898 in Minsk, just to unite the various revolutionary organizations of the Russian Empire into one party. Lenin joined, Stalin joined at the age of 20. Now, this is significant that it formed in 1898 because this is the boom, the beginning, and the intensification of industrialization in Russia. Therefore, we have an emerging proletariat. And we have a kind of tiny bourgeoisie. And this comes into play. So during the second Russian Social Democratic Labor Party Congress in 1903, the party split into two factions, as you mentioned. The Bolsheviks, the majority, and the Mensheviks, the minority. Now this majority-minority applies to the way the RSDLP members voted on the statute of the party and on the organization of the party. Their vote on party agenda had been unanimous, and that was to work for democratic socialism, to accept Iskra, the political newspaper of the Russian political emigres, which was really concentrated in the group around the political newspaper of Russian socialist emigre called Iskra, the Spark. And this was established as the official organ of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. And Iskra had, as I said, the six editors. Among the most prominent were the older Plekhanov and Lenin, who was in his early 30s, I think, and Martov, who became the leader of the Mensheviks. Now, the editorial line of Iskra championed the battle for political freedom as well as the cause of socialist revolution, and opposed the economists. They were known as economists, and they argued against political struggle in favor of pure trade union activity for the workers' economic interest. And they also opposed the socialist revolutionaries, the Iskra group, who advocated terror tactics. Now, let me see if I have something else to say about the Iskra group. The Iskra group, you know, the Iskra newspaper was for popular distribution and was very popular until 1983. I think it is, until 1903. But they also published a theoretical journal, Zaria, and this was really the initiative of Lenin in London. This was happening in London. So, but the in 1923, Lenin said that Bolshevism as a stream of political thought and as a political party had existed since 1903. And what he meant was that in 1902, he had published his first major work, What is to be Done? And there he stressed the importance of theory and revolutionary party guided by that theory. So in Lenin, I think this is the addition to Marx, I really think, at least the emphasis. Lenin stresses the importance of theory and a revolutionary party guided by that theory.
Right.
He says, without revolutionary theory, there can be no revolutionary movement.
Right.
The role of vanguard fighter can be fulfilled only by a party that is guided by the most advanced theory. So what he wanted in the Bolshevik party that ticked off the Mensheviks who became the Mensheviks was a quality, not quantity. He wanted trained professional revolutionaries who could do the guiding. Of course, this was then extremely opposed by Trotsky as, you know, centralization, autarky, etc. Lenin, in What is to be Done, goes on to quote Engels that the theoretical struggle is just as important as political and economic struggle. So this, of course, criticizes the economists who argued, who were for trade union activity and waiting around until capitalism will soften and whatever, but it's really social democracy and trade unionism.
Yeah, I mean,
and by the way, Trotsky started as a trade unionist.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so what I'm saying basically is what it does is it concedes almost the moral authority, but in any event, the existence and the continuing existence of the existing political economy, you know, of a capitalist mm-hmm. economy, and says, however, you know, we can go to the table organized as best we can as workers, and we have power inside those relations, and we should exercise them. That power, and we will maximize our position that way. It's both evolutionary in terms of how it looks out, as opposed to revolutionary, but also what it does is it seeds the legitimacy of the existing political economy as a given, and that's really a central ideological point of divergence from Lenin and the Bolsheviks.
Yeah, I mean, Lenin goes on to quote Engels that the theoretical struggle is just as important as political and economic struggle. The working class will not, and this I think is so important to realize for us, the working class will not spontaneously become political simply by fighting economic battles with employers over wages, working hours, and the like. In other words, the trade union politics is not going to lead you to revolution. And we know today that wages, working hours, and all kinds of improvement that happened under the Roosevelt administration for 30 years of the New Deal are all taken back.
Right.
That's the importance of a revolutionary outlook. And and that was what Marx meant by permanent revolution. I'm not going to talk about that because I'll go crazy today if I go into permanent revolution. But what Marx meant in 1850 when he said, okay, fine, the proletarian is weak, we have to ally ourselves with the petty bourgeoisie, but do not forget that the workers have to have their own party, their own organization. They have to keep the idea of revolution alive among them. And he ended the speech with permanent revolution, you know. But but it means that the working class can be bought off by the bourgeoisie.
Which is what we saw happen. You know, you had a couple of phenomena that, and I don't want to get too far off the track yet either, but that we saw develop. Number one, with the U.S., for example, and Western Europe intensifying imperialism over time, there was extra money when they went out looting the planet, and they brought money back to the castle, and they were divvying it up. Well, there were a few shekels that they could throw to the workers to keep them calm domestically and have them go into the army and defend it and all of that. And, of course, after a while, when that money dries up, they turn around and eat them. And then when you had the Soviet Union existing, and also China before the split, as an alternative to the world, you had pressure on the system here again to satisfy some of the demands of workers. And so the working class here following that line accommodated it. They said, okay, great. Here's an advantage for us. Now we can pressure for higher wages. We can get all the benefits that they did get, the welfare state in much of Europe and all of that. And then, you know, once these guys turn around and decide the time's up, they just turn around and start taking it away. And because there's no independent base and there's no critique of the system that allows workers to say, oh, okay, fine, well, this is over. You guys are out. Bye. It's our state.
In addition, we're off now. In addition, those workers who got the benefit back from the colonies, well, they didn't. So what happened in Western left in the 1960s, for instance, in France with Algeria, didn't give a damn about Algeria. It was roused by Sartre and those people. About the colonial situation, about the colonized. This is a critique that Mao makes. This is a critique that Lenin made in the beginning, you know, the support of colonial people. So the Western left became an aristocracy of labor, thought of itself as, oh, gee, we're getting all these benefits. We don't need to look at the colonial world. But where today are the jobs gone?
That's right. You know, Malcolm X and Lumumba and a whole lot of people brought this question up also back in the late 50s, early 60s. And Malcolm wasn't even a socialist at that point. And yet it was evident to people that were familiar with the struggle of people of color, third world peoples, etc., that this wealth that you guys think you're generating, you just stole it from my living room, you know?
Yeah. To return to Marx was saying, to get back to what Lenin was saying. He said to convert the working class to Marxism, Lenin insists that Marxists should form a political party, a vanguard, a dedicated revolution of dedicated revolutionaries to spread Marxist political ideas among the workers. This is, I think, an important observation. Are workers born with the gene for revolution?
Of course not.
Do they have an instinct for revolution? Would anybody, if they have what they need?
Of course not. This is an essentially Marxist, you know, a foundational Marxist thought anyway. You know, workers, your consciousness is a product of your material condition. I guess that's the philosophical statement of the approach to it. In which workers don't have a gene for revolution. They have a condition that breeds revolution, or they don't.
That's right. So if they're made aware that those benefits that they get are conditional upon the whims of the market, of the interest of the capitalists, they have to know that these are always in danger. That's where the permanent revolution business comes in.
That's right.
It's a tactic to preserve, to go on, because the alliance with the bourgeoisie, the benefits that you get within capitalism are provisional.
Right.
They can always be taken away.
Right.
So what you have, and I think there is a quote somewhere by Lenin, just a second, I'll get to it. Yeah, you have benefits under bourgeois government, and that's not permanent.
Right.
So this pamphlet, What is to be Done, was really the prelude to the split of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party between Lenin's Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks. Now, just to see where Bolshevism, the character of Bolshevism as wanting a vanguard party and masses of people acting but guided by the party, this character emerged from the struggle of the Russian Social Democratic Workers Party against, I think, three forces within the original party. One was the Narodniks, that were the Narodniks, the group that they were revolutionary populists, and they placed the driving force behind the coming revolution or the desired revolution among the peasantry, whereas Plekhanov, who was older than Lenin but was working with Lenin and Iskra, broke from the Narodniks and said, no, the driving force of the revolution is the proletariat. And this is also significant. The party was founded in the 1890s, just as industrialization, at least in Petersburg and certain big centers and in the Caucasus, was taking off. So the Narodniks had placed the hope for the revolution in the peasantry, and now the proletarian was being elevated to the driving force at this point by the theorists of the what became the Bolshevist branch. So the Bolshevik character emerged from the struggle with the Narodniks and then with the struggle with the legal Marxist. And it also emerged from the struggle with the economists, which we just outlined. And with the legal Marxists were really basically your liberals. What happened in Russia in the 1890s is that the Russian bourgeoisie was opposed to feudal autocracy and absolutism, and so was friendly toward Marxist ideas. But of course, like all the bourgeoisies in everywhere else, they really weren't that interested in revolution and were liberal. I mean, this
right.
is what Lenin called them. The economists we have talked about, and apropos of them, Lenin said, "A trade union policy for the working class is simply a bourgeois policy for the working class," which sums up everything
right.
that we've been mentioning.
Right.
He said that political and economic agitation, both, not just economic, you know, for wages, trade unionism, political, this is where he's going towards. We must seize power eventually, you know, in the April thesis. So he says both political and economic agitation were needed to raise class consciousness of the masses. In other words, the masses learned as they got involved, as they agitated.
Right.
But they agitated for things larger than just
right.
reform or you know, the wages, the benefits.
Right.
And Lenin said the two could not be separated.
Right.
Since every class struggle is essentially political.
Yep.
So the legal Marxists, who were in essence a bourgeois group advocating bourgeois policies through a Marxist idiom. Now, you see, we have the economists, the trade unionists. They are an authentic working class movement, the economists. But they are trade unionists and they're easily pacified. The other branch, the legal Marxists, they're called legal Marxists because they want to get to socialism through parliamentary devices. Right. And they essentially insist on the stages of revolution that Marx outlined in the Communist Manifesto, which Lenin altered, I think.
Yeah, with the benefit of Lenin had the benefit of another, 60 or 70 years of history that unfolded. So,
the benefit of the Paris Commune.
Right. And,
there was a bit of history and he had Marx.
Marx's own system. And, I mean, look, when we're talking about scientific socialism, when we're talking about a scientific approach to history and human development, science looks constantly for new data to challenge its assumptions and to help further formulate them, to process them. And so, of course, I mean, there are people that think that what fell out of Marx's fingers in 1848, that's, as sacrosanct as God's word and not to be challenged. And Marx himself would criticize that highly.
Yes, yes. And, I mean, this is the sort of an idealistic, like a god, a divine worship of Marx, the infallible prophet, and it's entirely bourgeois.
Yes, it is. And actually,
to regard him as a Bible, to regard his 1850, he was saying permanent revolution, and then that becomes this phrase that Trotsky spends years elaborating.
Yep, and look, this is something that resembles the history of Christianity, both in the Roman tradition and also in the Orthodox tradition. We got to stop there. At least we now have an agenda. We made our way through item one. Luciana, I'm looking forward to speaking with you again next week. And we'll work on number two. Next week will be Trotsky and Lenin in the years after 1905, the Prague Conference, Vienna Conference, etc. Thank you very much for your time. We appreciate
it. Thank you, Don. Always a pleasure.
Yes. That's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.